Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 65, section 3, which is old single column, page 733. Okay, so in the preceding session, we made it through that rather lengthy section 2 that you may recall took us through the whole span of evolution in summary fashion with an emphasis on the top-down engagement of mind to the evolving biologic systems. You know, in contrast to, you know, mostly looking at it down there in the details of all that biologic evolution, we went all the papers that take you through all those hundreds of millions of years. And as they were finishing up that section, they were transitioning from, you know, what you could say was effectively the mind-made part of the story, right, with that mind over control of the evolutionary process, moving into the personality-managed. They were giving a couple little comments about the role of the life carriers. You know, the author is one of them. The role of the life carriers in very overtly managing, guiding, as you can see from the title of the of section 3, fostering that evolutionary process. Imposing the necessary tweaking on the system so that it, when all is said and done, it's appropriately purposed. They embed an awful lot of the purposing in the actual DNA and structures themselves. Knowing how mind will engage those structures, but they can't do it all that way. There has to be some in the moment active imposition of the purposing, step by step, throughout the process. So between the two, the internalized purposing and that external purposing, the system ends up, you know, in our case, getting those first two will creatures in a pre-sangic stock just as they planned from the beginning. So now in this section 3, they're going to speak a little bit more on the life carrier's father-like engagement of the system, that you know, intervention aspect, as opposed to, like I said a moment ago, putting a bunch in the, you know, in the beginning and then having the influence of God the Mother just take things forward according to the plan. So it takes both a father-like and a mother-like hand. The Universal Father isn't directly involved. He's delegated all the way down to the life carriers, right? But it's nonetheless a father-like engagement along with the mother-like. So both parents are effectively involved in the process of bringing life into existence as it's planned. So let's just get into it a little bit here and see what they have to offer us here.
3, the fostering of evolution. It will hardly be possible to explain to the present-day human mind many of the queer and apparently grotesque occurrences of early evolutionary progress. A purposeful plan was functioning throughout all of these seemingly strange evolutions of living things. But we are not allowed arbitrarily to interfere with the development of the life patterns after they have once been set in operation.
Okay. So the language strikes you a bit there, right? Queer, grotesque, strange. Notice, however, apparently grotesque, seemingly strange. You should not need me to explain that, but I'm going to anyway. Obviously. Yes, when you look at it just with factual eyes, relative to, if that part might not be so apparent, relative to the normal world, it's apparently grotesque, seemingly strange. If you just look at it with factual eyes, you're going, what on earth is that distortion of the normal, very efficient, methodical process that a normal world goes through to get from single-celled plant to will creature? What on earth is this bizarre, what I eventually discover was an intermediate state, or what on earth is that tangent about, right, that just goes nowhere and is a dead end? So if you just approach it with factual eyes, there's apparently grotesque and seemingly strange. But obviously, between the lines is, but it isn't really grotesque, it isn't really strange, the difference between appearance and reality. And the reality is there to be recognized in the truth that's flowing through that, which appears grotesque. But it isn't in truth grotesque, it's just temporarily, in fact, grotesque. Okay, we bring that up all the time, and they use the word grotesque, that very strong word. Don't eternalize that statement. They aren't saying that it's grotesque relative to eternity. There's nothing that's grotesque relative to eternity. That's a grotesque thought, to think that there would be such a thing, right? It's just with limited insight into what's going on, something can appear to be grotesque, our ideas, religious ideas, say, right? In fact, they're grotesque. If the revelators used the word religious for them, even though they are, in fact, grotesque, is saying that despite the fact, despite all appearances to the contrary, there really is a superconscious relationship to genuine religion in that individual or that group of individuals, but consciously, temporally, okay, it's pretty minimal and quite twisted. But you can call them a religionist, in spite of what they have consciously. The great example is if they call a religion just that, a religion, when it doesn't believe in a personal God. Simply by definition, that couldn't be a religion if there's no God, but they call it a religion anyway. Why? Because superconsciously, the individual has a genuineness, religious nature. It's just what's going on consciously is quite limited relative to that. So in truth, they're religionists, but in fact, no, so-called religionist. So, very similar thing here. The contrast between fact and truth, or the contrast between appearance and reality. I mean, they aren't identical, but you have a similar relativity there that they often bring up. So, here we're just, for us, it would be very difficult for us to be objective enough in looking back, say, in the fossil record and finding something that to them is quite strange and going, wow, that's grotesque. I mean, it's just sort of, isn't that the way it always is? We just take it for granted. But relative to, the beautiful efficiency, on a normal world, from those eyes, right, it's labeled bizarre, right? Grotesque, strange, queer, weird, whatever word you want to use. Now, and it must be, that it's quite, quite different, and in a very seemingly twisted way, for them to use a double whammy like that of queer and grotesque, okay? So it gives you an idea of just how far from the norm this world is for them to use strong language like that. Right, but anyway, despite all of that oddity, if you will, on our experimental world, it nonetheless made it to precisely what they planned from the beginning. Pre-Sangic will creatures, right? We're, despite rebellion and default, we're still a creature that can be engaged by the spirit of truth. We may not use it that much, but it can still engage us, right? I mean, we can still be father fusers, right? Even if your adjuster is twiddling its thumbs, waiting for something significant to happen in your mind. But nonetheless, it's there, right? We aren't so limited that we can't even potentially be a father fuser, right? See, that again just reminds you. See, it was just apparently grotesque. There was obviously a thread of truth flowing through that, because when all is said and done, even with all the vicissitudes, a father fragment can still relate to my mind in a mode where I could eventually fuse with that fragment. And it isn't just there, in temporal fashion. It's there in potentially eternal fashion. Okay. So that's the emphasis on the apparently and the seemingly there, right? I could properly dedicate the rest of the 2 hours to just stressing the difference between appearance and reality, how important that is, how unrecognized that is, how everyone has a tendency to think that the appearance is the reality. Just very much challenge yourself to be humble enough to at least pause and consider that, before you set the appearance of your experience in stone and declare it to be absolute reality, especially when if it's a spiritual experience, right? Don't forget that you actually don't have access to the reality. You only have access to the appearance. Okay? You want to work constantly to not let that slip in under your radar. That you're setting this in stone. You're running with it. You're going to predicate all of your interpretations of everything after that point on your assumption that that what was presented to you, what appeared to you, what was immediately perceived, was the reality of it. You definitely don't need any upgrading in your ideas about God. Right? You have direct access to an unadulterated, unconfused, unfogged, right, relationship to God, and you're certainly not even going to let an epical revelation call into question whether or not the appearances of your spiritual experiences are reality or not. Right? I mean, it's so
important. We'll never be able to directly engage.
No matter how sophisticated scientific instruments get, right, in the fifth stage of light and life, or whatever you want to imagine, those scientific instruments still can only engage appearance. Right? The only way to know the reality of something is to have it revealed to you. Right? And if
you understand this, it does inspire you to faith.
Well, more than faith, have more trust, more humility.
Yes.
And that's the kind of the punchline I was leading up to, right? I mean, why this isn't just an intellectual issue. Especially when it gets very personal, like personal spiritual experiences. That's when it's the most difficult. If you haven't recognized that there's a reason why, for a long, long time, religionists have assumed that there's a special mystical faculty, right? Because way back to the ancient Greeks, we figured out that there's this appearance reality differential. And religionists didn't like the taste that recognition left in their mouths, while calling into a question the absolute integrity of their personal spiritual experiences, right? And so, the assumption was made and continues to be made that only applies to everything except, right? It's like, no, the paper 103 is very clear. I mean, not even your adjuster is an exception, right? That paragraph in paper 103 about how everything has to go into your mind and is subject to its limitations and everything, including your relationship with the adjuster. There isn't some special mystical faculty that makes it so that you engage directly the reality of your adjuster and not an appearance. And by appearance, fundamentally, I'm not talking about your subjectivity. I mean, that's a huge issue too. As soon as it's dumped into your mind, it's subject to your subjectivity. But separate from that, there's just the fact that, I mean, the easiest way for you to understand why there's some additional limitation, but besides your subjectivity, we're talking about appearance and reality. We're talking about objective. The objective appearance and the objective reality. I mean, it's not a subjective issue. It's an objective issue, right? Objectively, right now, you are finite. I hope you believe that. Now, I hope you don't believe that you're absentite or absolute. Right? You're finite. There's a relativity, inescapable, right? No matter how objective you are, you're still finite. Right? No matter how objective you are still not yet perfected. And even when you're a finaliter and perfected, you're still, hopelessly incomplete. Right? Imperfect, incomplete, finite, right? Those are relativities that are inescapable. And even when you're a seven-stage spirit and you're an absentite being, you're still just an absentite being. Right? you're still an infinite distance away from absolute reality. Right? So it's very important, to keep that in mind, that you only have access to the appearance, and you're attempting, as you interpret those experiences with that appearance, you're attempting to bring in revelatory assumptions to make those interpretations valid. There's still going to be interpretations of the appearance, but they're predicated on initial assumptions that are grounded in the reality that's been revealed to you. And so those interpretations are true instead of false. They're objective. But they're still, another simple way to remind yourself of this, of how you're limited to appearance and not reality. Really, the entire cosmos infinite, in every infinite detail, is already in existence. Right here, right now. Do you see it? No. Could you somehow develop your mystical faculty and see it? No. even if you had it, right? The cosmos infinite is already exists, completed. Time is not a reality. It's an appearance. Right? Cosmos infinite is already there. Cosmos infinite isn't waiting for the reality of time to tick to its endpoint to come into existence. It already exists. Every detail, complete.
In infinity.
Right? Not just here, but all the way to it, literally infinite distance. The entire cosmos infinite already exists. That's a big, that's the biggie, to stop realityizing time. And that's one of the things that the revelators try to challenge us with. Time is an appearance, not a reality. The absolute of time is eternity.
But it is nice to go through the experiences of time.
Right. But so what, but see, what is it? What is it we're doing? Right? We are slowly opening our eyes, the relativity of our eyes, if you will, until finally you can see the cosmos infinite. What is the cosmos, what's the appearance of the cosmos infinite right to you right now? What you see. This is the appearance of the cosmos infinite in this room when you look around. It's not the reality of the cosmos infinite, but it is the appearance, the objective appearance. Objectively, there is a table there. That isn't a subjective thing. There objectively is a table there. Okay? But what's the reality? You're slowly trying to get into relationship through a long process that we tick off with the thing we call time, to be able to see the reality of the cosmos infinite. You're not waiting for it to come into existence. It already exists. Okay? I mean, the fact that it already exists, that's why this very relative fact of the appearance can be objective. Right? And not subject to you. Okay? Unless you start getting very flipped around. Well, actually, that table doesn't exist unless I observe it. Right? If you start getting Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics about it, see how ridiculous that is, how completely flipped 180 degrees around that is. No, the cosmos infinite exists, and that table is an appearance relative to my ability to engage it, and it's objectively there. It has nothing to do with my observing it. There's nothing subjective about its existence. Okay. But an absentite being doesn't see what we see in this room, right? When an absentite, when the master architect looks out from the Isle of Paradise, all of the four outer space levels are already there, completed, right? They see absentite worlds. We can't see absentite worlds. Right? They see an absentite geometry. Right? I mean, there's a spot in the book, I can't remember where it is, there's a spot where they even, mention absentite worlds as if they already existed, because they do. If you're an absentite being, that stuff is already there. So I mean, that's one of the biggest challenges. You know, here we're spending all this time talking about evolution and this stepping along in this temporal process, but remember, that's just from our vantage point.
But it's nice to know.
From a time viewpoint, you've got this, right? And it's important to get an objective relationship to the time viewpoint. You don't want a totally subjective relationship. There's obviously no way to get reality if you can't even relate to the temporal objectively. You know, there's no way to get to eternity if you can't relate to the temporal objectively. So it's very important. But just, you know, keep in mind this is a huge challenge that the Revelation is putting forward, that humans have never tried to think about reality like that before. To take the appearance reality thing all the way.
Geometry would look like?
Yeah, who knows? I mean, you know, it's three-dimensional.
I want that, really.
Right, but...
I really want it.
And I want it now.
Yeah. But again, you know, when you project the absonite geometry of the central universe into the finite, it appears to be all in a plane. But it isn't really. That's an appearance. Again, you get to the Isle of Paradise, and it appears to be a pancaked elliptical thing. But that's not what it is absolutely. Keep that in mind. This book is written by finite beings, right? They've never experienced the Isle of Paradise or Havona in a super finite way. All they know is the finite appearance. They know it very, very precisely and very, very well, right? Appearance and reality is a relative thing. I mean, it starts with simple things like this table appears to be continuous, right, as a solid. But, you know, it isn't really. It's really made out of molecules, and they're made out of atoms. It's actually mostly holes and not, solid.
More space to
it. Right? There's more not than is, right?
Is it in motion?
But reality, that first relative reality, it appears to be little static thingies, but they aren't really, right? I mean, you know, really, it's made out of ultimatons, and ultimatons are units of motion. Right? But again, you're never going to have a scientific instrument that's going to, that's where they're going to appear that way. You just know they are because that's been revealed to you, and you construct your physical theories predicated on that fact. I mean, it's just like right now. I mean, there's no instrument that's going to, change the fact that the nucleus appears to be a collection of protons and neutrons. Right? That's the scientific appearance. That's objective. But it's not, really, it's a single particle. All those things like that. See, and just to remember to not just think about that in the scientific realm, if you will, right, or the material realm, but that, spirit is a substance in the external world too. And at best, you have access to the objective appearance, not the reality of it. You have the appearance of God, not the reality of God. In your experiences, but they can reveal the reality of God so that you know it despite all appearances to the contrary. For instance, God really loves me intimately, even though it appears that he doesn't care because I stub my toe all the time and why do bad things happen to good people? It appears God doesn't care. I mean, no amount of telling you the reality that he does is going to change the fact that it appears that he doesn't. Right? You have to know the reality of God's love despite all appearances of the contrary. Your eyes aren't going to suddenly go different, and it's like, oh, now it doesn't appear that bad things happen to good people. I mean, it's always going to appear that bad things happen to good people.
Well, but
right,
you do get to where you see the good things.
Right. Well, you know, you recognize. See,
right.
as well as
you can recognize the bad.
See,
so to speak.
And Jesus didn't have a mystical faculty to guide him around this, right? He knew that no real harm could befall him, despite all appearances to the contrary. That's a philosophic sentence about the difference between appearance and reality. Right? Jesus, sees apparent harm, but he knows there's no real harm. Right? You don't get to just see reality. Right? If you could see reality, besides the fact that you'd be a creator being instead of a creature, I mean, what would be the point of trust? Where would trust fit into the picture? Right? It's that differential between the appearance and reality is where trust comes in. Okay. I could have done 2 hours, but I did a half an hour. So it's a very, very, it's always there throughout the whole book. You want to challenge yourself that way, because humans are, there's only a handful of humans in all history that have really challenged themselves like that, and now almost no one does. I mean, the best minds on the planet seem to be oblivious to the difference between appearance and reality. They're constantly calling the appearances of scientific observations the reality of things and stuff, right? There's just no humility there anymore. Again, like paper 103 points out. So back here. So with this fostering of evolution, besides the seemingly strange and the apparently grotesque things, we saw above, remember how they said above that that whole bit about the Eastern group of life was having issues with its human potentials, and so with the consent of their superiors, they manipulated the environment. So in that mode here, they're saying, but we are not allowed arbitrarily to interfere. And they'll explain a little bit more here in the next paragraph. But we saw kind of a very definitive example of that, where if it's a very significant thing that they've got to do, an interference, not only can't they do anything arbitrary, but they've got to get the consent of their superiors as well. Okay, so they're not just going to be bored one day and do something arbitrary. All right, so let's keep going here.
Life carriers may employ every possible natural resource and may utilize any and all fortuitous circumstances which will enhance the developmental progress of the life experiment. But we are not permitted mechanically to intervene in or arbitrarily to manipulate the conduct and course of either plant or animal evolution.
Okay. They say something, but it's still pretty vague. Employ every possible natural resource. It's like, okay, give me an example. What are you talking about there? It's frustratingly vague. But the one thing you definitely can see there, we're not permitted mechanically to intervene in. Okay, I mean, they literally can't go in and alter any genotypes. I mean, they're not going to, rearrange, any of the chromosomes and anything, That's hands off. So there's no mechanical. Remember, they couldn't do that if they wanted, because they're not in the mode where they can engage it. Remember, we read about that at the beginning of the paper. But so they can't get that micromanaging and manipulative about it. It has to be relatively indirect. And again, emphasizing arbitrarily, they can't do anything arbitrarily. Even though they can't do any arbitrary manipulation, I mean, they're obviously manipulating the conduct and course of evolution. Just not, in some haphazard way. So, the conduct and the course, you know, I mean, just something that's more immediate needing to be tweaked, something that they're tweaking relative to more of a long-term issue. Either way, without any examples, frustratingly so, they do a lot of indirect personality management of the situation. Anything else on that? We keep going? All right.
You have been informed that your antimortals evolved by way of primitive frog development, and that this ascending strain carried in potential in a single frog narrowly escaped extinction on a certain occasion. But it should not be inferred that the evolution of mankind would have been terminated by an accident at this juncture. At that very moment, we were observing and fostering no less than 1,000 different and remotely situated mutating strains of life, which could have been directed into various different patterns of pre-human development. This particular ancestral frog, Ribbit, represented our third selection. The two prior life strains having perished in spite of all our efforts towards their conservation.
Were you identifying with this particular ancestral frog?
Well, it's my ancestor. Ribbit just came out. So.
Okay, so a couple things there. I mean, that last line, you know, it's kind of a zinger. It's like, whoa. Well, the third time's a charm, I guess. Right? But it's interesting to note that, you know, as they're saying there, in spite of our efforts, right? So they're doing their best, but it's still, oops, okay. that one's a dead end. And, you know, this whole bit about no less than 1,000 different and remotely situated mutating strains, between the lines there, you have to wonder, do you suppose it's always that broad? Or does that have something to do with the life carrier? I mean, the life experiment world, right? That the life carriers have to, you know, they seem to be emphasizing remotely situated. You know, it kind of suggests that they're sort of preparing for lots and lots of potential vicissitudes. They have a pretty solid idea of all of the basics, how they're going to roll out, but there, you know, as they'll mention, there are certainly some secondary issues that catch them by surprise. Because after all, they've loosened things and they're letting the Supreme sort of play out more fully so they can get some data on the current, you know, functioning of the Supreme at that point in time. It seems like, you know, just the fact that they say no less than, everything seems to be kind of suggesting that they were in a mode of making sure that they didn't get caught flat-footed, you know, by the vicissitudes.
Which yeah. could have been directed into various different patterns.
Yeah, and see, not only, I mean, they've even pre-thought a whole bunch of different ways to get to the same endpoint.
Which they could have. You mentioned this a couple of classes ago, or maybe yeah. a month or so ago, about the fact that once the evolutionary process reaches the suddenlies or reaches the thing, the other things that are in progress that could have been sort of stopped being could have beens anymore, correct? In other words, there's a point. You know what I'm saying? Like, once the humans came up, they weren't coming up anywhere
yeah,
else.
Yeah, see, it's only at that point. That comes up here in the next okay. couple paragraphs, actually. But let's go ahead and put it here. When they're saying that about the more that are not less than 1,000 different ones, we're in the first phase here of the adjutant overcontrol of the evolutionary process. And that's why, you know, but it should not be inferred that the evolution of mankind would have been terminated by that accident. The overcontrol is in maximum avenues forward mode, and seeking to take every avenue all the way to the finish line. It's only when you get the first two will creatures and it goes into the second phase, right, that it partly shuts down, as we'll read here, like I said, in the next two paragraphs. It's still going to be pushing things forward, but it won't push anything over the will dignity line.
So these other 1,000 kept moving on?
Yeah.
I gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what they're about to explain in the next two paragraphs here. So why don't we just leave it there and on that point, and we'll get a little bit more. Let me make sure did we miss anything else in there? Let's see. I guess the one thing that I was emphasizing, just to appreciate when the Universal Father delegates, like I was saying. I mean, this is a father-like intervention we're talking about here. You know, when the Father delegates all the way down like this to the life carriers, it's not like they embody some absolute wisdom or anything, right? And that delegation by the Father has a lot of trust embedded in it. The Father trusts in the integrity of the system, the integrity of the personality of the individuals, that when all is said and done, it all will come together and fit into a whole. Right? This doesn't work because the Father is not trusting, and hence he makes these very perfect, infallible, all-seeing, deputies that are functioning in his name. Right? As they're stressing there at the end, in spite of all our efforts toward their conservation. And, I mean, obviously, if you had some very vast being doing that, I mean, there would never be, oops, oh, okay, I got it the third time. It wouldn't work that way. And it goes all the way down to us, right? I mean, we are the most remote extrapolation of this. There's going to be lots of oops, right, in our lives. But despite all of that potential to not get it perfect the first time, the Father trusts you absolutely with a measure of absolute purposing. Just know there's always a way forward. It'll always come out in the end. It seemed like a good idea at the time, events, stop you dead in your tracks, right? Just pick yourself up and keep going. The one thing that you need to do that the Father doesn't need to do is you need to acquire experiential wisdom. Right? And the only way to do it is in the wake of the oops. Right? Because the only way to get it is through tribulation. So, yep.
I just don't understand when it says you've been informed that your ancient mortals evolved by way of primitive frog development. And that this ascending strain is carried in potential in a single frog. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't understand that sentence. I mean,
okay, so we, as they explained to us, you got from the single-celled plant to the first two humans by going through a particular type of amphibian called a frog. I mean, That was the path that leaded from point A to point B was through frogs.
You've been informed in a previous paper,
right? Yeah, there's that. And then, okay, this ascending strain. Okay, so even though it looks like the frog just came into existence, and there's still frogs today, it doesn't look like there was anything ascending there. It appeared to be ascending up to it, and then it went horizontal from there and is still alive today. But in truth, something ascended through that. The frog wasn't pure scaffolding. It went on as an ongoing foundation, but there was something that after the frog. It was predicated on the frog. You know? So we ascended through frog form. Initially, humans were shaped like frogs. They weren't, in fact, humans yet, but they were pre-humans. They were, in truth, humans when they were just a frog, you know, or just a trilobite, or just a single-celled algae right at the very beginning. Okay, and then the parenthetical there, carried in potential in a single frog, they're just reminding you that on this planet, it just happened that it was through a particular frog, that particular frog's descendants, that you got a suddenly to the next notch up from frogs, up to reptiles. Okay. You know, you trace humans back, and you eventually get back to one frog as an ancestor. Okay, and that's just a coincidence of how it worked on this planet. Okay, and you know, and so that whole bit about if it had jumped 2 inches less, remember, right? You know, it would have died. Well, then you wouldn't go back from Andan and Fanta to that particular frog, as they just said. There's no less than 1,000 other ways that you would have gone back from Andan and Fanta to something. It just wouldn't have been to that one frog. There were many ways to get there.
It's pretty amazing to think that, I mean, the humans had, or whatever they were, scales and...
Well, again, see, it just, I mean, again, they're not literally, in fact, humans, right? They're frogs, right? Right? It's, you know, no different than a frog today. It's just that you know, that's a form through which what followed frogs went. You know, just to think of it as, you know, again, it's a little bit like when I was trying to describe, you know, that the cosmos infinite exists right now, but even though you can't see it, you know, what you're trying to recognize is, instead of in one step making Andan and Fanta, right? There's this process you go through where slowly you're opening your eyes, and you open them a little bit and it looks like a trilobite. You open it a little bit more and it looks like a frog. You open it a little bit more, it looks like some ape, you know. You open a little bit more and there's Andan and Fanta, right? You're just slowly seeing it unfold. The reality of what it is. Initially, the will creatures appear to be frogs. Initially, they appear to be not even animals, but just plants. You know, and they're very primitive. But see, just seeing it in truth, even though literally you don't have a single object, you know, that is morphing, right? It's going through this whole process of many objects. But see, there's a truth that's flowing through all of those facts. So that in truth, you could think of it as just two objects that go from two single-celled plants to Andan and Fanta. Even though in fact it didn't work that way. But in truth it did. It went through this whole complicated, you know, think about how many organisms in fact it went through, you know, to get to those two organisms, right? But in truth, it all ends up, you know, it's just two organisms. And I see all that complexity, countless organisms, you know, in fact, almost uncountable number, but in truth, there's just two there. And all said and done, two are standing. You know, you didn't end up with 100 million humans in the first, you know, wave, just two. And all that stuff, all those hundreds of millions of years, in truth, there's just two humans in all of that complexity. You know, it's just kind of fun to think about that, you know, to think about the truth of a phenomenon rather than just the fact of it.
Yeah, be frogged by much.
Okay, all right, so like I said, now they're going to give us, you can see these two paragraphs are set off by big paragraph breaks because I refer to these all the time. These are the biggies about the specifics of getting close to the will creatures. Okay.
Even the loss of Andan and Fanta before they had offspring, though delaying human evolution, would not have prevented it. subsequent to the appearance of Andon and Fanta, and before the mutating human potentials of animal life were exhausted, there evolved no less than 7,000 favorable strains which could have achieved some sort of human type of development. And many of these better stocks were subsequently assimilated by the various branches of the expanding human species.
Okay, so we'll just start with that. I mean, they get the technical thing about the first phase, second phase, third phase in the next paragraph. But you've got these animals that are being drawn upward by that engagement of mind. You have a whole hierarchy of mind, and basically the material systems are being drawn up in parallel to that hierarchy, engaging mind being engaged by mind at an ever higher and higher level. And then eventually you get the first two will creatures on this planet. It was very straightforward. You just had an initial pair. The adjutant ministry shifts gear, goes from the first phase to the second phase at that point. As I was just saying a little bit ago, but you continue, the adjutants are continuing to draw everything upward, as it were. There's a lot of human potential that needs to be brought into existence. But you aren't going to literally actualize that potential, bring it across that threshold anymore. But as they pointed out, even the loss of Anna and Infanta, if they had been killed immediately, the adjutants would have shifted back into the first phase and taken one of those other, that eventually, when all was said and done, there were no less than 7,000 of these strains, but another one of those strains would have been drawn up and would have crossed the will dignity line again. Sixth adjutant would have engaged, seventh adjutant would have engaged, circuitman and the Holy Spirit, personality identified. Right? You would have gotten them up to will creatures. As they're pointing out, okay, Anna Navanda didn't die, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't this whole upward movement still happening. So that there was eventually a lot of different animals that we were biologically compatible with and then backmated with. But as we often don't remind ourselves when we say backmated, that's not all a negative issue. And because there are human potentials that have come into existence in those animals. And so those human potentials get incorporated into those Andonites. And can become part of a human phenomenon, can get actualized, in the context of human mind-spirit engagement, mind-spirit ministry. We don't know how many of those 7,000. Some of them were undoubtedly, very different, where they weren't sexually attractive. Some of them might have been extremely small, maybe no one was, there was no backmating with them, But we would look back and we go, I think there were these really small humans. It's like, well, they may have been biologically compatible, but they may not have been actually human. They may have just been very fancy animals. That you might have been able to engage and teach to, repeat words to you and stuff, like a lot of animals can be taught to, say things and whatnot, but they weren't genuinely human themselves. You got to wonder how many of these, roughly 7,000 strains were alive not that long ago, right? And there may actually be even some myths about them, at least, some vague, historical memories, if you will, of them. They could have been very big, very small, whatnot. Some of them were just right, though, and got mated with. All right, there, And many of them, many were in the Goldilocks zone, obviously, here, and got mated with. All right, so let's read that other paragraph, because it's the rest of the story here.
Long before the material son and daughter, the biologic uplifters, arrive on a planet, the human potentials of the evolving animal species have been exhausted. This biological status of animal life is disclosed to the life carriers by the phenomenon of the third phase of Agent Spirit mobilization, which automatically occurs concomitantly with the exhaustion of the capacity of all animal life to give origin to the mutant potentials of pre-human individuals.
And so you see, you've got, remember they tell us in our case when it got to that point, when, I mean, again, we're not, you know, notice how they keep pointing out human potentials, not human actuals, you know, actualities, but just human potentials. All this, you know, throughout all of the animal world, you know, everything has been brought up as high as it can be brought up, even if it isn't literally amongst the Andonites, but even, you know, in the Andonites, you know, the human potentials are continuing to come into existence within them, as well as in all the animals. The whole system has been brought up relative to human potential as far as it can be brought up. And they tell you that that happened about 40,000 years ago. And the life carriers said, okay, we've tapped it all out. It's time for the biologic uplifters to come. And, you know, we got an inspection, and 2,000 years later, we got an Adam and Eve. So, you know, when they say they're long before the material and son and daughter arrive, well, that's relative in our case. I mean, you know, if you think 2,000 years is long, okay, it's long. But it was way too long for Adam and Eve. They only made it 100 years, right? And, you know, okay. So, yes, this long is a relative word. But the whole point is that, you know, that it, when it finally has maxed out like that, that's when the biologic uplifters come. It's so the you know, the mother, if you will, takes it up as far as possible, and then there's another father-like intervention that initiates a new foundation, and then the mother takes it up subsequent to that new initiation. That's the basic back and forth between the father and the mother. The father initiates, and then the mother's the way up from that starting point. And there's plateaus, you know, or there's highlands in this whole process. You know, it levels out and then needs to be sparked again, and goes up and levels out and needs to be sparked again. And you know, you literally have the name they give for our local universe indicates it's a local upland, that Don part. You know, that you know, you've taken it up to one of those plateaus, and you're going to need a new kind of spark to continue on up from there.
So is there a spark like that at every transition, like going from the past all the way to light and life, the seventh stage of light and life? Does every one of those stages have to have
a... I mean, you know that there's, you know, planetary mortal epics.
Yeah.
Right? You know, that's the basic thing. You've got the, you know, the mother takes it to a certain maxed out state, and then there's another father-like intervention of magisterial sons or a bestowal son or Trinity teacher sons or whatever it is, right, to initiate a new foundation, you know, to turn the ceiling into a floor and to build up again until you get to the next ceiling, and then you turn that ceiling into a floor and build up from there, and on and on and on you go. And I mean, like I say so many times, you finally sort of get to a really huge ceiling of getting all the way to Yversa, and then you turn that ceiling, that spiritual ceiling, into a spiritual floor, the floor of the central universe, right? And you build up from that foundation, right? What seemed to be the absolute ceiling becomes the absolute floor, right? They do it to you and you get inducted into the core of the finality. It's like, okay, now I've gotten to the ceiling. No, now you've just gotten to yet another floor. And the first thing that becomes so apparent when you get onto that new floor is just how big the space that you're in is. You know, if you go up to the ceiling, it seems that you're going up to this apex. It's like, oh, okay, I've got it all figured out. I'm all locked in, right? But it's actually the neck of an hourglass. You know, you can think of it in the hourglass analogy, and boom, it opens up. It's like, no, right? It's even bigger.
Get out of a billion worlds.
It just keeps doing that and doing that.
That's
you'll be floored. So what's the third phase?
Okay, yeah. So that's like I said, that's the where they use the technical term third phase of agitant spirit mobilization. So I've been saying with it, what's the first phase? What's the second phase? So the first phase gets it up to the first will creatures, and then it shifts. It's not going to take any across the will creature line. It'll take them right up to the line, but not across the line. So the second phase, you're continuing to bring things up, but nothing over the will creature line. Just everything is being maximized in terms of the human potentials without any further actualization, a new actualization. No parallel across the will creature line. Until that's all maxed out, and then it goes into the third, where it's supplying the over control environment to maintain what's been brought up, but to go up from that floor, right? I mean, it takes it up to that ceiling. Sort of that second phase ceiling is going to become a third phase floor, right? But how do you go up from there? Well, a lot of it, as they're about to point out, is in our hands, right? When you think about what this all means to you individually, all these potentials are latent in you, and you need to supply the favorable conditions for those potentials to actualize. You have lots and lots of human potential that you're completely ignorant of. Right? If you would supply the favorable conditions for mind to engage you in a more holistic, higher mode, some of those potentials could actualize. If you just supply the favorable conditions, right, for that kind of actualizing engagement to engage you. Okay?
Just thinking of the biblical saying that the lion shall lie down with the lamb.
Uh-huh.
Not the lions of today, and the lions of today. No. The ones that will lie down together will not be what we know today.
Yeah, right. I mean, you can take this beyond the humans. Just exactly what the animals will be like, you know, deep in light and life on this world is a giant question mark. Like we've talked about so many times, there aren't carnivores on the architectural spheres. You don't have to worry about being attacked by a voracious, lion in the gardens of Edentia as you're strolling along one day, right?
Just a mosquito.
So... But just keeping it for the time being on the humans, what's a way that you can think about what that third phase is about for you as an individual? It's about that whole self-mastery process. Right? Self-mastery is actualizing your human potentials. Right? I mean, Your personality is a potential. It's the potential to actualize the energy potentials material, mental, spiritual of your nature. It's a your personality is the potential for your energy potentials to be something besides potential. Right? And it's sad to record that so few persons on your rancha, right, are actualizing all of these latent human potentials, including some of the really cool ones that came from the back meeting that are still waiting to be actualized. The potentials got fed in, but they're still unactualized. Why do we still languish and stumble along in moral darkness? Because most of our human potentials are still just potentials. They're not actualized. It's like, but I want them to be. Well, that's not enough. If you're wanting to be, doesn't... No amount of consecrating your will is going to actualize those potentials. Right? It's that other consecration. Right? That consecrating your will, that's the establishing of the floor. That doesn't move you up off the floor. Right? The Father just changed the ceiling changes the ceiling to a floor. But the Father doesn't do anything about first story, second story, third story. That's all in the hands of the Mother. That's all the consecration of your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. That's the supplying the favorable conditions to be grown. Right? So you have all these people that have earnestly consecrated turning the ceiling into a floor, and they've done it. We've got lots of first milers with floors, right? But nothing built upon them.
Right? So if you think about what we were talking about in the very beginning of the class, to bring them out there in a way where people can be okay, can see the benefits of this in the...
You can see how, you know, you begin to wrestling with just what a challenge the fifth ethical revelation is. Just for you as an individual to finally get what it's all about, and then it's like, wow, it's going to be difficult to find a lot of people that are ready for such revolutionaries in many ways, reorientation of their worldview. Yeah. So, and it's, you know, but you start, you know, you get just endlessly frustrated if you try to bite off that great big piece. You know, start with yourself. Just start with working on yourself, you know, and getting the new wine out of the old wineskins. You know, seeing the revelation for what it's really trying to tell you. Not what it appears to tell you in the old wineskin. Again, you can do the appearance reality on that differential. Okay? Yep.
Well, plus in that, you know, use your own experience and wisdom. You know, like, at this level, you know, you've been reading the Ranch book for umpteen years, and you've got, and you're getting, you come to class here and stuff, and you get a whole, you know, upgraded perspective. You know, and some of the things he's saying... You know, he doesn't tell you how to do them. He's saying things you have to figure out for yourself. But
yeah,
still got to do it. But you know, I still believe there's millions of people in the world who would be able to embrace it. You know, the way you embraced it when you first got into it, and then gradually they would then, you know, move themselves up over time. You know, they're not going to come in at the level that we're talking about here.
No.
They're going to come in at, you know, the beginning levels that, you know, we first did. So, you know, that's really kind of, in a way, a challenge also is, you know, how do you grind up the grains of truth in the right place and feed them to people and so on and so forth. I mean, to me, that's the really exciting thing, you know, figure that out. And you can follow this, to me, you know, here again, it's like all of this is, you know, being an experimental plan, it's an experiment, you know, and it kind of went this way and, you know, and they're learning while the experiment's unfolding. And I think we're going to be able to do the same thing. But as Meredith Sprunger says, you know, you've got a revelation of truth here. For heaven's sake, act. Do something. You know? And so it's like, and at the same time, as he was saying, you know, you're still trying to, you're focusing on your own personal development. But I think, you know, I don't know how you say it, but the mother part of that is also, how do you, you know, there's something inside you that wants to take this gift and be able to share it. I don't know what it is. It's hard to explain, but it's just there.
Yeah. You know, all that is valid. See, all we're trying to add is you need all those people that are coming in at that introductory level, but there needs to be a phenomenon in addition to them so that they have the potential to continue going forward and not just enter the doorway and then stand and then, you know, in the entryway for their whole life.
That's true.
Right, so there needs to be this handful of people that have, you know, been mentored forward so that they can then mentor those behind them forward. We need to get the hierarchy, you know, set up instead of all of us on kind of on the initial starting point plane, right? You know, why do you want to bring them in? Just so they can stand in the doorway? No, you want to bring them in so that, you know, they can continue to grow forward. So we're, you know,
because you love them,
right? Because you love them. You want them, you know, to you want them to be able to begin to put the revelation in new wineskins, because anyone you know intimately you know is struggling with something, and you probably know that it's like, if only they could look at that in a different way instead of the way they're looking at it, you know, where they're just besetting themselves with unnecessary burdens. Right, you know, if you could get them to put it in a new wineskin, right? You know, things like, why do bad things happen to good people?
Or like a lot of people anything, struggling, right, with the religions of the world today. They don't really speak to them. You know, you need to sort of wish you could say, oh gosh, you know. But that here again is something that, you know, as you were saying, it just takes time. I mean, and the nice thing is we're quivering on this brink that's going to, you know, start to help, I think, probably help make that happen. I don't know if we get to a point of fourth, whatchamacallit, fourth phase.
No, I mean, you know, there won't be, you know, there isn't going to be any, you know, fourth phase in the mode that they're thinking here. There's just, effectively what continues to take you up is what goes beyond adjutant ministry. I mean, adjutant ministry in and of itself only takes you up so far. I mean, just think about the quivering on the very brink. The whole point of getting the adjutants to dawn in the collective one after another is to finally get the seventh adjutant dawn in the collective, but that ceiling becomes a new floor, right? The whole point is to begin to have a collective phenomenon that's transcendent of merely the fanciest of adjutant, you know, expression, to actually have the Holy Spirit, you know, functioning in a collective mode instead of an individual mode, right? Which means the Spirit of Truth could begin to function, you know, in that context in a collective mode. Add the adjusters could begin to have a more collective Spirit of Goodness manifestation on the planet instead of just merely an individual sort of a mode. See, there's all kinds of, you know, endless, you know, potentials, you know, upon, you know, but it all, I mean, it's just, it does boil down to there has to be a number of individuals that have begun to journey beyond the starting point and can encourage the people coming up of why they need to put in all the effort to keep going. There's great things that come that aren't apparent to you now. It appears you're just gonna you're gonna lose more than you're gonna gain, but that's just a temporary thing. When you finally can let go of some things, you can grab a hold of things that are even better. And you can't see that right now, but you have to trust me. I can testify to it. I've went through that. I'm on the other side, the beginning of the other side. Right? Trust me, let go.
And you have the biologic issue, yeah, which I think is what,
okay,
we're
anyway,
going to get into, right?
Yeah, we can go on and on. And like we said, all these topics are very open-ended. But okay, so just, you know, all the times when I refer to, you know, this issue about first phase, second phase, third phase, this is where it's coming from. And just the thing to carry away with it is what I was trying to stress there at one point. There are lots and lots and lots of potentials. All of the potentials in the entire system were maximized and embodied within us. All those potentials, all those hundreds of millions of years are waiting latent within you to be actualized, that take you forward from the material comfort era all the way eventually to the seventh stage of light and life, as we actualize all those potentials. All right, what else do they say here?
Mankind on Urantia must solve its problems of mortal development with the human stocks it has. No more races will evolve from pre-human sources throughout all future time. But this fact does not preclude the possibility of the attainment of vastly higher levels of human development through the intelligent fostering of the evolutionary potentials still resident in the mortal races. That which we, the life carriers, do toward fostering and conserving the life strains before the appearance of human will, man must do for himself after such an event and subsequent to our retirement from active participation in evolution. In a general way, man's evolutionary destiny is in his own hands, and scientific intelligence must sooner or later supersede the random functioning of uncontrolled natural selection and chance survival.
Right, and you can see that whole random, to use that very strong word of random, uncontrolled natural selection. Have you ever thought about this overemphasis on natural, right, that we talk about so much? Right? See, the whole point is for it to be controlled, right, to be unnatural. It's predicated on genuine religious character, right, an art form.
A tough topic in today's world.
A tough topic, right? An unnatural topic. That's part of the challenge. It's a tough topic because we've so overemphasized and we've so demonized unnatural. Artificial is a negative word now. Not surprising when you consider what a lot of people call art. Gene.
Earlier, talking about the life carriers, it says we're not allowed arbitrarily to interfere with the development of the life patterns at the event. Okay.
Yeah.
Will we be under that same, should we, if we were wise, be under the same prescription, or are we not?
We can do whatever we want. We'll quickly discover, if you do that, that's icky. Let's not do that again. Right? We'll develop wisdom. But our free will is respected.
So, Chris, is that uncontrolled natural selection and chance survival, would that be like having sex with anybody and then having their child?
Yeah, right. So, yeah, the one little thing I wanted to point out, the fostering and serving the life strains, if it's not obvious between the lines, you have two basic facts. That we are doing as our personality management of the system. One is under the banner of eugenics, and the other is genetic engineering. Right, so between genetic engineering and eugenics, which requires scientific intelligence, not just science, especially not just technology, there'll be lots of oopses there. Genuine science has a truth to it, so its application is helpful. A so-called science, not so much. Okay, they're just reminding you that on a normal world, once you have the will creatures, basically, the beginnings of eugenics and genetic engineering are in play. It starts out with some rudimentary eugenic stuff that the prince's staff fosters. That eugenics continues on with the Adam and Eve, and they start to bring in genetic engineering, You know, and after their 25,000 years getting things going, you're going to have full-on advanced genetic engineering going on the planet. They're pointing out here that these latent potentials aren't all just there to be actualized merely by thinking about it, you know, which you might have thought maybe I was suggesting a little bit earlier. You know, it's not just a totally internalized issue. You're using your greater mind to have a greater science, and so you're approaching this materially and mindily.
And it's funny that it's thought of as being anti-God. You know, the whole artificial thing in a way.
But again, my personality came from where? The Universal Father, what I usually call God. My personality is not anti-God, right? God has entrusted purposing in me. See, just think about how much we have to overcome all that that false anti. It's like, no, right? You've been literally given a measure of the total purposing by God. He can't do that purposing anymore. You have to do it. You've been entrusted with that purposing. You have to do that quote-unquote God thing, that degree of purposing. Right? Part of the universe is going to be personality managed by you. And you're the only being that can do it. The Eternal Son can't do it. The Conjoint Actor can't do it. Right? The Master Architect can't do it.
You have to do it with the thought of the be perfect. In other words, do it the way you think I would do it, right?
Yeah.
God.
Of course.
So it's kind of interesting.
But just appreciate how, you know, that's between the lines here. It gets started very early. What I'm trying to stress that, you know, that delegation of the Universal Father, I mean, bestowing personalities is fundamentally that delegation of himself, right? Part of that delegation went to you and is ultimately in your hands.
Yep. Terrible, terrible sadness is the fact that we get our Adam and Eve defaults, our the Caligastia and Lucifer, you know, that whole thing there. The only and then Melchizedek came, yes, and Jesus, he felt so much pity for us. He came here, you know, and then he killed him. I mean. Why, you would think that the Most High's rule in the kingdom of men, well, you would think that they would think, okay, now, this person's going to do, they know they're going to do it. They have the will, you know, and they let them do it. And here we're stuck with all this stuff.
But again, you have to know that it appears that we're stuck, but we really aren't. See, it's impossible to be really stuck with all this stuff, because really means it's in eternity. It's not. It isn't in eternity. It's just in this passing moment of time.
And the fact that you're saying what you're saying and experiencing that.
Yeah.
So think about that. Think about the fact that you are experiencing the bottom of the barrel, the lowest of the low, as Mother Teresa would say. You know, I mean, it's and that how much you are going to gain from that as an individual, you know, and how you can. You know, bring that forward to other people, you know, other beings who never will experience it like you are.
Yeah, not to mention this, you know, take it all away. You know, you pine to be a Havona native, and a Havona native pines to be you.
Yeah, right.
Right? There's nothing more in the universe that a Havona native would wish to be is you on this world right now, default, rebellion world. Coolest thought ever.
They're stuck.
They would give up anything to be you here and now.
Rebellious teenager.
Right?
Because they see the end.
Yeah.
There's the egg and daughter steal thing, and then there's the, you know, something wonderful comes out of all of the stuff.
The potentials that you have that are utterly, absolutely beyond their reach. Right? The only way they'll ever get them is indirectly from you, right? All right, let's...
And in discussing the fostering of evolution, It would not be amiss to point out that in the long future ahead, when you may sometime be attached to a corps of life carriers, you will have abundant and ample opportunity to offer suggestions and make possible improvements in the plans and techniques of life management and transplantation. Be patient. If you have good ideas, if your minds are fertile with better methods of administration for any part of the universe domains, you are certainly going to have an opportunity to present them to your associates and fellow administrators in the ages to come.
And that's, you know, just think about that in the wake of what I was just saying about what was delegated to you by the Father. See, that's why. You have a unique measure of the total purposing. You and you alone can offer certain things to the universe. You know, that's why it says you are certainly going. Right? And then, of course, there's a wonderful exclamation point after one of the five basic favorable conditions, right? Be patient.
So you think if we have some ideas right now, like I have a couple?
So it appears.
You think we'll remember?
They tell you if they're worth remembering, you know, you'll wake up with them. But they tell you, remember, as you work through the mansion worlds, a number of things that appeared to be good ideas, you know, it's like, oh well, okay, now that I have a little bit bigger picture. Like, for instance, I'm pretty sure no one's ever thought of this, and then you discover, no, a couple people have already thought of that. but
it didn't mean I forgot it.
But nonetheless, we already really discussed that paragraph a lot as I was expanding. See, that's the whole point, is that you have a unique element to contribute. You'll have abundant and ample opportunity. It is kind of funny to me. It would not be amiss to point out a little measure of it's okay within the revelatory mandate, you know, that it would not be inappropriate, you know, to point out. So they give you that little tease. You may not feel a lot of tension in that regard, but there are some people that feel a lot of tension in that area. So they're trying to help those people. It's like, okay, just start up. There's plenty of time. Don't get frustrated. It seems like you've got all this stuff that you can contribute and you can't find any way to do it. No one will listen to you, you know, whatever. I have this great invention idea, you know, but no one will fund me or whatever, right? You know, don't let that become a stumbling block frustration for you. All right, let's get into the Urantia Adventure here a little bit.
For the Urantia Adventure. Do not overlook the fact that Urantia was assigned to us as a life experiment world. On this planet, we made our 60th attempt to modify and, if possible, improve the Satania adaptation of the Nebadon life designs. And it is of record that we achieved numerous beneficial modifications of the standard life patterns. To be specific, on Urantia, we worked out and have satisfactorily demonstrated not less than 28 features of life modification which will be of service to all Nebadon throughout all future time.
So there's obviously a whole bunch of things they discovered, and they're giving you, and in terms of big scope for the whole local universe, there's not less than 28.
So it didn't say not less than 29, so it must be
28. I was trying to explain why they say it that way. See, it's not less than 28 in that big picture, but for smaller issues, you know, or for shorter spans of time, there's, you know, who knows how many things they discovered, okay? So in other words, they discovered a lot of them, and not less than 28 of those are biggies, right? All of Nebadon throughout all future time. Right? So these experiments have sweeping scope. Again, it's because, remember, they're testing the supreme. They're testing the whole, you know, relative to the finite. So that's why it can have such sweeping, they can make such sweeping discoveries. Because they're testing the foundation of all the finite, basically.
Do you think any of them were, uh-oh, don't do that again?
nothing that extreme, but they're going to mention something along that line in a little bit here, so I may not vamp on that. Go ahead.
But the establishment of life on no world is ever experimental, in the sense that something untried and unknown is attempted. The evolution of life is a technique ever progressive, differential, and variable, but never haphazard, uncontrolled, nor wholly experimental in the accidental sense.
Okay, that's basically self-explanatory, but just, notice things like that you might not stress so much, nor wholly experimental. Right? Nothing is being done out of the context of the whole. That the literalness of an experiment, you're trying out something, the literalness of the word, the X parts you're trying out. Let's try out something that's fundamentally antithetical to the totality of the finite, to the supreme. No. Right? Okay.
That's why they need permission sometimes.
Yeah, in terms of some of the interventionary things, yeah. Those who have a bigger sense, have to sometimes step in, yes.
But they may try things out in their labs before
they do. They're going to mention that again here in the next block here.
I'm not reading
that. but they obviously wanted to stress again, because we could certainly go off on a false tangent with the experimental world label, right? So they just pounded into you here in this paragraph.
I just had a thought about this. So it seems like, these life carriers are kind of like technicians making really awesome tools and medium, and then this marvelous artist, the mother, is using these tools and just kind of guiding them to where she wants them to be and doing the final finesse to make it amazing whatever she needs to do.
Yeah, as detail-oriented as they are, they're still just sort of the rough carpenters, if you will. And all the fine details is grown by the mother. And the mother's always the finishing carpenter in the process. These guys come in and, put in the studs and and the ceiling joists and whatnot, right? But
so we could call the supreme the final finesser.
Yes. And all the finishing touches, are entrusted to the hands, because only the whole knows how to do it just so, taking everything, past, present, and future, every nook and cranny of the entire finite into account. Right. All right.
Many features of human life afford abundant evidence that the phenomenon of mortal existence was intelligently planned, that organic evolution is not a mere cosmic accident. When a living cell is injured, it possesses the ability to elaborate certain chemical substances which are empowered so to stimulate and activate the neighboring normal cells that they immediately begin the secretion of certain substances which facilitate healing processes in the wound. And at the same time, these normal and uninjured cells begin to proliferate. They actually start to work, creating new cells to replace any fellow cells which may have been destroyed by the accident.
Okay, so just giving you a little picture there and challenging you with words like elaborate. Think of the root word labor there, right? I mean, the word is literally meaning work out, right? When you have the ex prefix in that mode, it's like that. But it's, the way we were confronted with a situation, and it's like, well, we can work this out. We assess the situation and we come up with a plan to deal with it. I see they're trying to get you to, in a way, anthropomorphize what's going on there with the wound healing process, to get you to recognize this, like, okay, it isn't literally that anthropomorphic picture that you're visualizing. But remember, there are beings, us, behind the design of that. So you're not totally false in anthropomorphizing it. It is actually like a whole bunch of little laborers just set to work because we designed them to function as if we were there as workers down there with our little fingers doing what needs to be done. Right? They're just trying to get you to reflect on the way just that one issue of the body functions. And we'll see in a minute, in the subsequent paragraphs here, why they brought up this particular issue. But it's just one of many they're pointing out, that if you would just reflect on how amazingly, seemingly foresightful and transcendent some of the things going on in the body are, it's like, yeah, how would that have evolved where it seems like it, foresight is embodied into the structure? Yeah, obviously it didn't just, you know, bottom up evolve that way. It was designed that way. Someone with foresight built that in.
And animals have that too.
Right, and everything has that. Right? Single-celled creatures have, measures of this sort of stuff. Yeah. So, again, they're just trying to get us to look top down on stuff, and you'll see. Remember that it's all about top down in this paper, right? The over control, right? Just how you can, if you would look at things from the top down instead of bottom up, it's so trivially obvious that it isn't just some accidental phenomenon that it's designed. Okay.
This chemical action and reaction concerned in wound healing and cell reproduction represents the choice of the life carriers of a formula embracing over 100,000 phases and features of possible chemical reactions and biologic repercussions. More than 500,000 specific experiments were made by the life carriers in their laboratories before they finally settled upon this formula for the Urantia life experiment.
Right. See, so there's what you were, what you're teasing at, right? So just for that one thing, right? They run more than 500,000 experiments. Okay, so yes, I mean they don't have this just innate transcendent wisdom that they apply. They get wisdom the same way you do. They went through all these experiments. Oh, no, that doesn't work. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. You know, and they have to run so many because they have to take into account, you know, all of the possible things that that finesser that you were talking about might bring into play. It's like, well, what if the evolutionary process brings this into play? We've got to take that into account. What about this and what about that? And so and they finally have tested it from every angle. Right, then and only then do they put it in play, where they know it's fundamentally sound. It's not perfect in some, you know, high sense, but it's there's nothing fundamentally problematic that can befall it. It can handle any potential vicissitude and get the effective end that they're looking for. You know, to be in place. Okay.
What's right.
That? Oh, let's see. Was there everything? I think we got everything there, didn't we? Obviously, the need for a number of experiments. There is also in the fact of how complicated it is, right? Just one little issue over 100,000 phases and features, right? Just think about how many experiments in total they would have had to have done.
Yeah.
Right.
Multiply that by the number of different issues.
Different, like, quote-unquote, subsystems, if you will, in your body. I mean, you know, good grief.
It's a big number.
Right. Not to mention all of the interactions between subsystems and right, just huge.
Give you a headache.
When Urantia scientists know more of these healing chemicals, they will become more efficient in the treatment of injuries. And indirectly, they will know more about controlling certain serious diseases.
Why don't you read the other next paragraph, too?
Since life was established on Urantia, the life carriers have improved this healing technique as it has been introduced on another Satania world. in that it affords more pain relief and exercises better control over the proliferation capacity of the associated normal cells.
All right, so there's the, oh, I see why they brought up this particular one. Yeah, so if you wondered why we have such a problem with cancer, right, this is why. Right, they discovered that, you know, not just cancer, but, you know, tumor formation in general, the proliferation capacity is not controlled enough. So they tweaked that so that it's more innately controlled and can't squirt off in these uncontrolled fashions with tumors and cancerous phenomena like we have here.
And do us all a lot of good.
Not to mention, you know, pain relief too. They've got that improved. But obviously the biggie that we really, although pain relief is, you know, with all of the opiate addictions and stuff, is becoming a huge thing too. So both of these are plaguing us, you know, extensively, that were modified in the wake of what they observed here.
But there is hope. It says when we know more about them, will be better, more efficient right. to be able to treat them. So right. maybe we can reduce that.
Right, we can do, you know, we can get to, you know, we can genetically engineer ourselves as if the life carriers had built us with that modification that they've done subsequent to us. Right. So we can, you know, we can get it in place as if it was. Just, again, it's going to have to be us, not them. You know, and this is another reason why when the revelators speculate that that when Machaventa, you know, actually makes himself planetary prince, he takes over that overtly, that he'll also take on the role of material son, not literally as a biologic uplifter, but the whole genetic, you know, teacher role of material son. You know, instruct us in eugenics and genetic engineering so that we can do things like this. You know, you're not going to cure cancer by somehow just trying to manage the current system. You have to change the system fundamentally. We need to re-engineer ourselves and do that in a way that it you know, doesn't just improve this situation, but doesn't make other things worse as well. I mean, think about how complicated this is, right? But we'll, you know, we're going to have to learn all of that complicated stuff where you can handle over 100,000 phases and features and 500,000 experiments and all that complexity.
So we ain't cured cancer for a while.
But we can get rid of the cancer, but the patient usually dies.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, anyone can cure cancer by killing the patient. So, I mean, just notice how, you know, obvious that one is, you know, that it's like, oh, you don't have to be a medical doctor or anything, you know, I mean, it's just trivially obvious what's between the lines there.
What do you say then, all the conspiracy theorists who think that we're all being poisoned and GMO to death?
Yeah, so think about, yeah, just for a moment, a little sidelight. I mean, that, you know, those who go off on those tangents that the reason we have cancer is because of all sorts of environmental issues and whatnot. It's like, okay, yeah, that can be involved in, you know, in the problem. But fundamentally, it's a genetic issue. It's just like is it not the case with everything in the book? You know, why are you having such problems with government? Well, it's a genetic issue. That's the bottom line of almost every problem we have. It's fundamentally a genetic issue. No amount of redistribution of wealth is going to fix it. It's a genetic issue. No amount of cleaning up your environment is going to fix it, because fundamentally it's a genetic issue. We need to literally, you know, re-engineer ourselves genetically to fix these problems.
Well, they discussed that just in the paper,
yeah.
This section before,
yeah.
Which is tough.
Yeah. So again, it's one of the, you know, why do you have such unfortunate religious beliefs? it's a genetic issue. Everything is foundationally a genetic issue. It's just a, you know, I mean, it's why, I mean, see, and you can overcome to a degree that genetic deficiency by taking more delight in cultivating, right? I mean, you can overcome some of your genetic limitations, but big picture, long term, there is no long term solution that just happens by me, you know, getting better self control. I mean, if we all had maximized self control, that's relative to our limited estate. That still puts us way short of the first stage of light and life, right? I mean, we just don't have the biologic foundation. No matter how much you maximize self-control, to be in the first stage of light and life.
So I have a question.
It's just the way it is.
Is it because better genetics enables mind to see better on it?
Yeah. I mean, we need a higher floor. See? I mean, that genetic engineering, you're lifting the floor up, right? You can't build a building that's as high as the first stage of light and life on a floor that's as low as we have.
So
it just can't be done.
Genetics, then? Do we lose them when we shed our bodies? Or are you speaking of?
Well, again, this is not an individual salvation whatnot issue. This is the planet going forward and trying to get to light and life. Your genetic issues as an individual, you know, are fixed when they build you a new body on the first management world.
Yeah. So, like, eventually what they'll do is a man and a woman will go into a laboratory, basically. They'll check their DNA, they'll check their genetics, they'll see what they're disposed to, you know, what diseases are in their bodies or their genetics.
See, again, the main, you know, our first thought is, we can not have diseases and stuff. I mean, that's just step zero, right? I mean, you know, the whole point is to be able to have a light and life-like mind.
Right.
Light and life isn't no disease, no matter how much all the people that were clamoring around Jesus thought that light and life was being cured of your diseases. You know, I mean, remember those basic biologic issues? That's the first mansion world. Right. So what happens after the first mansion world? Well, humans basically haven't imagined anything, you know. You know, what if you had all of your material issues fixed? Well, that gets you to the second mansion world. Yeah.
Sure.
Yep.
The one thing I wanted to say about the poisons, we are dealing with many.
Yes, we are.
There's chemical reactions that are not good for us. I'm just thinking, too bad we're not better stewards of the environment.
Yeah. See, but just you know, make sure that you don't add the ism to the environment. It's not a complete lifestyle solution.
I know.
You know,
it's still a
all. You know, nothing is a dichotomy. Everything.
It's
an issue. It's just remember that the foundational issue is genetics.
Yeah.
Right.
But I don't think
so,
you should let us off the hook.
Of course not. It's not a dichotomy. Right.
The world is being poisoned.
Right. But just appreciate that we can have a perfect environment. You know, and none. You know. No matter how perfect the environment is, my genetics haven't changed.
I know.
That's, you know, see, that's what doesn't change.
I mean, this is a good example of, for instance, why do you get lung cancer if you smoke a lot? Well, obviously, it looks like that you're causing damage to your cells, and they're going to start to proliferate. And
but
stop,
if you'd gotten biologically uplifted, you could smoke as much as you want, and you wouldn't get cancer. You couldn't get cancer. Right.
But for now, we're not.
You know, or if we were on that other Satania world where they improved it, you wouldn't get cancer no matter how much you smoked. See, it's fundamentally a genetic issue. Yes, there's environmental triggers, but it's fundamentally a genetic issue. Okay, let's keep going here.
There were many unique features of the Urantia Life Experiment, but the two outstanding episodes were the appearance of the Andonic race prior to the evolution of the six colored peoples, and the later simultaneous appearance of the Sangic mutants in a single family. Urantia is the first world in Satania where the six colored races sprang from the same human family. They ordinarily arise in diversified strains from independent mutations within the pre-human animal stock and usually appear on Earth one at a time and successively over long periods of time, beginning with the red man and passing on down through the colors to indigo.
Yeah, so just the thing to just see, the transition from the first phase to the second phase is a lot more complicated in a normal world. See, as they're pointing out, you've got see, especially that whole bit about diversified strains from independent mutations. I mean, you know, you've got the adjuvants functioning in this, you know, if there's six races, in this sixfold parallel mode, bringing groups across the line. So you have all six colored animals, right, in existence, you know, and then it brings the red ones across the will dignity line, and then the orange ones, etc., and how each of those lines came into existence is this very parallel phenomenon. So it's quite complex on a normal world what the adjuvants are doing, you know, and until they finally get the indigo across the line, the animal human line, right, it wouldn't be fully into that second phase. So it's they're just reminding how complicated.
Talking about other worlds, they say appear on Earth,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, when I first read it, they didn't mean here.
Yes. Yeah. Every dirt ball is an Earth for every inhabited world, yes.
So what you were saying earlier, when they said they had maybe, 7,000 or whatever different places, where then when Anand Fontok came, the rest of them didn't go up.
Yeah.
But they did backmate with some of those pre-human types. Yeah. What this is saying is that on a normal world, when one of those goes to red men, the other pre-human types are still evolving and
one goes and going across the line. See, it's much more complicated.
Totally
see, see, it's very complicated on a normal world.
That's a big change they made for here.
Yeah. See, the adjuvants are functioning in a very different way here, because in terms of the details here.
And
yeah.
One family, they say. Was
and then all that, bringing it all to a focus in one family, right? So it's very different the way it found, to go forward on this planet. Remember, too, that some of those near-human strains that we backmated with, they weren't biologically compatible at the time of Anand and Fonta. It was only sometime subsequently that they were finally brought up high enough that they were biologically compatible.
Right? Even though we're still animal.
Yeah, so that's one thing they try to point out. Right? They continue to rise up, and so way down the road from Anand and Fonta, you have ones that got up high enough that you could backmate. So right, backmating was a rolling phenomenon, right, as new backmating potentials came into play. Okay, keep going.
Another outstanding variation of procedure was the late arrival of the planetary prince. As a rule, the prince appears on a planet about the time of world development. And if such a plan had been followed, Caligastia might have come to Urantia even during the lifetimes of Andon and Fanta, instead of almost 500,000 years later, simultaneous with the appearance of the six Sangic races.
So that simultaneously, they mean like basically simultaneously. Once we had the Sangics, he came. Because, literally, he could come and have been here before Andon and Fanta died. And so that's like, boom, they're all ready to go, and they hit the transports, and they're here.
So I wonder who chose that variation of procedure.
Well, that's just simply because the Andonites, that was all pre-planned. They're about to tell you that in the next paragraph. Okay. that it's all pre-planned because the Andonites are not civilizable. Right? They're not high enough mind to be, they can have a society and a culture, but not any sort of significant civilization. They just aren't personal enough yet. They're persons, but limitedly so. Okay, keep reading.
On an ordinary inhabited world, a planetary prince would have been granted on the request of the life carriers at or sometime after the appearance of Andan and Fanta. But Urantia, having been designated a life modification planet, it was by prearrangement that the Melchizedek observers, 12 in number, were sent as advisors to the life carriers and as overseers of the planet until the subsequent arrival of the planetary prince. These Melchizedeks came at the time Andan and Fanta made their decisions, which enabled thought adjusters to indwell their mortal minds.
Okay, so that little detail, now separate from the Melchizedek receivers, right, related to the rebellion, right, these are the Melchizedek observers. Who knows? There may have been some in both groups. We don't know. But this is, essentially a different set of 12 than the Melchizedek receivers. You can again see how important it is that Anna and Fonda are cut above the rest and get their adjusters in fairly short order through one of the prerequisite modes. You can see made the decisions which enabled. So one of those prerequisites of adjuster indwelling came into play. And they got their adjusters, allowing their children to get adjusters, the way we do naturally, basically. It gets the receivers, the observers, Melchizedek observers, in play in very short order. And there to, so that the life carriers can hand over the reins. Because once there's will creatures, they need to back off. See, and they can't hand it over to the planetary prince, so they have to hand it over to someone. Yeah. Okay.
On Urantia, the endeavors of the life carriers to improve the Satania life patterns necessarily resulted in the production of many apparently useless forms of transition life. But the gains already accrued are sufficient to justify the Urantia modifications of the standard life designs.
Yeah, so just, again, encouraging you to take the big picture, right? But I don't like the negative issues of being this guinea pig.
Take one for the team.
we had to think about it. What you're experiencing is for the greater good, as we like to say on this planet.
For your greater good.
Right, and gains already accrued are sufficient to justify.
It was our intention to produce an early manifestation of will in the evolutionary life of Urantia, and we succeeded. Ordinarily, will does not emerge until the colored races have long been in existence, usually first appearing among the superior types of the red man. Your world is the only planet in Satania where the human type of will has appeared in a pre-colored race.
And of course, you notice it's kind of a small space relatively, just our local system that they're, right, it's happened other places.
So ordinarily, will doesn't come in the colored races if they've been long in existence.
Yeah, see, and that was a little thing. See, I wanted to just bring in, because I kind of...
They're not human yet.
Right, see, I mentioned that. See, the colored creatures are all there. For a long time, you've got red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo. Oh. Creatures.
They're just not
will creatures. And just think about how long you would have those indigo animals around before there's any indigo humans. Right? I mean, the red man is way first, and he's around a long time before there's any orange humans. There's orange animals, but not orange humans, etc. It's just a very different phenomenon in a normal world.
So the red man, once in a normal world, once he breaks through and has will, there will also be the potential for backmating bear too, correct?
Except remember how we pointed out that the Sangiks don't have that tendency.
Okay, right. Only the...
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So it's just that's a...
Okay.
Yep. And you'd have the planetary prince coming immediately when you got red men. But it'd be a long, long time before there's any the other ones like blue man, say that the prince's staff is ministering to. See, so it just their ministry is so different. You'd have all this kind of you know, a first child engagement with the red man, you know, before, you know. So the issues of, you know, Indigo Man would have to come to terms with, you know, he's like, oh man, a red man has gotten you, you know, all of the help from you for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, you know, or whatever, you know. So you can just, you know, imagine how, what kind of tensions there would be, you know, amongst the races because of that differential of ministry. So, you know, there's positives, there's negatives. It's all, you know, different modes. All right, let's finish up here.
But in our effort to provide for that combination and association of inheritance factors, which finally gave rise to the mammalian ancestors of the human race, we were confronted with the necessity of permitting hundreds and thousands of other and comparatively useless combinations and associations of inheritance factors to take place. Many of these seemingly strange byproducts in our efforts are certain to meet your gaze as you dig back into the planetary past. And I can well understand how puzzling some of the of these things must be to the limited human viewpoint.
But you notice they did it again. Seemingly strange. Yeah. And just so just as we started out, they end the same way in trying to get you to develop the eyes to see the truth of what you're digging up rather than just the facts of what you're digging up. And the other little thing that's kind of interesting they throw in there, because they repeat it, it makes it all the more noticeable. Combination and association. Combinations and associations. It's like almost pedantic, right? Why are they stressing that like that? Well, right now in our bottom-up material fact finder mode, all we think about with our genetics, for instance, is the combination part, right? The literal, you know, bringing together and making chemical compounds, gluing, you know, stuff together. The subtle issue of associations, you know, we're just barely beginning to consider this. And notice that's the second word, that's the foundation word. In the top-down point of view, right, the mind is more immediately attuned to the associations, say, between chromosomes or between genes on a, you know, in a particular chromosome. And it's a, you know, when you're going top-down, that's first. And then you get down to the actual nitty-gritty gluing molecules together, right, issues, the more mechanical material issues. See, so in a top-down mode, it's combination and association. Rather than bottom-up, it would be association and combination. Right? And that's the way we've discovered. You know, we started out, all it was a combination that we were considering. We're slowly starting to bring a little bit of association issues on top of that. But we'll never appreciate the fullness of that until we recognize that fundamentally this is all only truthfully observed from the top-down mode. Mind, then matter. You need to consider the mind, then think about the matter, rather than thinking about the matter and then occasionally saying, well, but maybe there's mind, like, kind of tacked on parallel to that as an afterthought. No, it's the foundational issue, the wholeness of mind in which the parts of the matter exist. So they end up again trying to emphasize the top-down mode. All right, well, we'll keep on and get some of the vicissitudes here, as you can see next. Obviously, you know, you just think about those comments they stressed about cancer there and stuff. I mean, there's so much potential for us to improve even what we could do without, you know, the help of Machiavelli, Melchizedek, as the material sons say. There's so much we could do if we would just take a more objective perspective, stop trying to convince ourselves that it's just a random combination of molecules that happens to be able to talk like this. Right? I mean, it's just so absurd. If we would just start to treat it as a designed phenomenon that maybe you know, needs a fan belt changed, right? Instead of, well, it's just a random thing, There isn't any purpose to all this stuff. You know, if we would stop doing that, we could go a lot further in improving our estate just on our own.
Of course, the spark plug initiates all.
Yeah. All right. So on that note, let's take a moment here, everyone.